Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present union and social justice activist Bill Fletcher Jr., who assesses the outcome of the 2012 election and shares his views on the post-election agenda for the labor movement and progressive activists. Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women, who talks about how the Republican war on women played a central role in determining winners and losers in the 2012 election campaign. And Reverend Sally Bingham, founder of Interfaith Power and Light, who discusses why climate change is an issue of concern to faith communities and the role her group played in the passage of California's groundbreaking global warming legislation, Assembly Bill 32. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
United States and NATO troops are set to leave Afghanistan in 2014 after a new Afghan presidential election. Already, aid budgets and troop levels are being trimmed back as hopes for a peace deal with the Taliban are fading and massive corruption remains endemic inside President Hamid Karzai's regime. Since invading Afghanistan in October 2001 in response to the 9/11 attacks, the United States has spent over $100 billion on reconstruction and development projects. Western aid has built a 350,000-strong security force and paid for 3.2 million girls to go to school. Yet with the Taliban continuing to prosecute a fierce guerrilla war, few Afghans have confidence in the future once NATO forces leave. Historians remind us that after Soviet troops left Afghanistan in 1989, the country was torn apart by a brutal civil war, paving the way for the Taliban takeover in 1996. Opposition leader Ahmed Zia Massoud, brother of the 1980s anti-Soviet resistance leader General Ahmed Shah Massoud, assassinated days before 9/11, warns of deepening violence if President Karzai or his allies try to steal the 2014 presidential election. Massoud asserted that every case of fraud in this election will take this country toward instability and this country will rise up. Proceeds from the illicit gold trade in the Democratic Republic of the Congo now fund rival militia groups, enabling them to buy weapons while forcing child workers to toil in gold mines. The gold is smuggled from the Congo through Uganda, Burundi, and Tanzania to gold markets in Dubai. There it is either melted down to make gold bars or made into jewelry sold in India. Gold bars are purchased by Swiss banks known as bullion banks, who in turn sell them to international investors. The Washington, D.C.-based advocacy group Enough Project released a report in late October documenting the route of the smuggled gold and stating that the conflict minerals provision in the U.S. Dodd-Frank Finance Reform Banking Law, which requires U.S. companies to track the source of the minerals they use, has been effective in cutting off supplies of conflict minerals such as tin, tungsten, and tantalum. Armed militias have set up multiple checkpoints throughout the region in order to extract payments from gold smugglers, who move 2 to 4 tons of gold out of the eastern Congo annually. The illegal gold trade short-circuits hundreds of millions of dollars of potential revenue to the Congolese state every year and prevents the local population from benefiting from the country's natural resources. In a sharp break with the past, Cuban Americans who voted in person on November 6th gave Barack Obama a slim majority. And in spite of losing the Cuban-American vote overall to Republican Mitt Romney due to a large number of absentee ballots cast by older Cuban-Americans, Obama still carried 61% of Florida's Latino vote. An exit poll conducted by Ben Dixon and Amandi found U.S.-born Cuban-Americans supported Obama by a 60-40% margin, while Romney won the votes of those born in Cuba by 55-45%. Increasingly, second-generation Cuban-Americans' voting patterns echo those of other Latinos in supporting Democrats. Across the country, voter turnout among ethnic minorities, including Latinos and Asian Americans, rose dramatically during the 2012 election. There's a chance now that the changing voting habits of Cuban-Americans could move U.S. policy away from confrontation and economic sanctions and toward the normalization of diplomatic relations. Anya Landau French of the New American Foundation recently observed, "For the first time in half a century, engaging Cuba is no longer a political liability. Done in a strategic way to advance American interests, engaging Cuba could be an asset in the one place it was long anathema, South Florida." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The Democratic Party victories from the presidency on down to critical House and Senate races in the 2012 election were in no small part made possible by the strong support of the nation's labor unions. By one estimate, earlier this year, unions were prepared to spend more than $400 million to help re-elect President Barack Obama and support Democratic congressional candidates. The coordinated Republican state-by-state assault on the right of public sector labor unions to bargain collectively made the outcome of this year's election campaign a high priority for unions and their members. Beyond the money contributed by labor, AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka announced that 400,000 union-based volunteers knocked on doors and talked to voters in all 50 states. In addition to dedicating time and money to the presidential and congressional campaigns, labor was also engaged in fights over referendum questions related to unions in two states. In California, unions defeated a Koch brothers-backed proposal that would have limited their ability to collect and spend union dues in political campaigns. But in Michigan, labor lost a bid to amend the state's constitution to prohibit the legislature from enacting laws that would curb the power of public employees' unions. Your reporter spoke with Bill Fletcher, Jr., an editorial board member and columnist with the online publication BlackCommentator.com and the immediate past president of TransAfrica Forum. Fletcher, the former vice president for international trade union development programs for the George Meany Center of the AFL-CIO, shares his views on the post-election agenda for labor and progressive activists concerned that President Obama will negotiate a so-called grand bargain that could cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid benefits in exchange for modest tax increases on the wealthy.
Labor was very essential in quite a number of states, and even in those that were not considered strategic for the presidential races, there were other elections that were underway where labor mobilized. But in the so-called battleground states of Pennsylvania, Ohio, Florida, Virginia, there was a very significant labor presence. Union voters voted roughly 65% for Obama. And that is fairly consistent with what has happened over the years, where somewhere between 25 and 30% of union members tend to vote Republican. So there was a very, you know, there was significant turnout on the part of union voters for the Obama presidency, candidacy.
One of the critical issues with labor is that many critics have long observed that the Democrats have taken labor for granted, the enormous support both in terms of people power and as well as the money contributed by labor unions to Democratic Party campaigns. But we also have a situation where very often labor's top priority agenda items are shuffled down to the bottom of the pile by the Democrats for expediency's sake, and of course not believing that labor has anywhere else to go, I guess, is the real issue.
Well, I think that that's correct, but I think that a lot of the blame actually lies with the leadership of labor, that the leadership of too many unions have been content to play second fiddle. They have been reluctant to develop a clear independent program. They've been reluctant to develop a independent organization, and I'm not talking about a third party, but an independent electoral organization through which they could participate in the elections, mobilizing union members and their families, particularly in primaries. Very often it's been justified on the basis of, we're not going to get a good deal from the Republicans. The Republican Party of today is out for blood, is out to annihilate us, so we have to work in lockstep with the Democrats. And what this fails to appreciate is that within the Democratic Party, at the leadership level, there are very important forces that economically do not share the same interests as working people. And these are people that we're going to have to struggle with. When labor does not have its own voice, when it's not perceived as being the voice for economic justice for workers, as opposed to just economic justice for its own members, then it is in a very defensive position, and that must change.
Last year, President Obama and Republican House Speaker John Boehner got together and negotiated a deal. It fell through at the end. But from our understanding, the deal would have slashed benefits from Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, raised the retirement age in exchange for some modest increases on taxes for the wealthy. There's a lot of concern that with this financial cliff and some of the other pressures on government to make some deals or otherwise the markets will go haywire, that there'll be pressure on the White House to come to some similar agreement this time, in the opinion of many progressive activists, in something that would amount to a betrayal of the folks who reelected President Obama. What's your view on that one?
I think that that is very obviously a danger. It would be more of a danger had it not been for the Occupy movement, which I think shifted the discourse in this country very significantly. But it is a danger, and what it means right now is that we've been through 4 years of Obama. We know that he has an irresistible impulse towards premature compromising as a way of displaying his bipartisanship. And the only way that will be blocked is by us. And that means regular people, those that voted for him, those that want to preserve the safety net, we're going to have to be in the streets. There may need to be more occupiers. There may need to be many, many more demonstrations. This is not simply about lobbying. This really can't be. This is not simply about posting something on Facebook or sending an email. This will need to be ultimately people literally putting on their marching boots.
That was Bill Fletcher Jr., a longtime labor activist who is co-author of the book Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Toward Social Justice. Find more views and analysis on the outcome of the 2012 election and the role of labor on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Continuing a trend over recent national elections, women played a central role in determining winners and losers in the 2012 U.S. presidential election campaign. According to a CNN exit poll, 55% of women voted for Barack Obama, while only 44% voted for Mitt Romney. Men preferred Romney by a margin of 52-45%. With women making up 54% of the electorate, the gender gap in the November 6th election added up to 18%, a significantly wider margin than the 12-point gender gap in the 2008 election. However, exit polls found that white women favored Mitt Romney by 56-42%, an increase of 3% over their support for John McCain in the 2008 election. The votes cast by women overall in this election constituted a clear rejection of the Romney-Ryan policies that oppose reproductive rights, access to contraceptives, and lack of support for pay equity, while the Republican Party platform supporting an anti-abortion amendment to the Constitution is silent on whether there should be exceptions for rape or other circumstances. The issue of pregnancy resulting from rape erupted into a national controversy when GOP Missouri Senate candidate Todd Akin asserted that legitimate rape rarely results in pregnancy because the female body has ways to shut the whole thing down. The controversy only became more intense when the Republicans' Indiana Senate candidate Richard Murdoch said in defining his position on abortion that pregnancy resulting from rape was something God intended. Related or not, women won a record 20 seats in the U.S. Senate and 78 seats in the House in this election. Your reporter spoke with Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women, who talks about how the Republican war on women exacerbated the gender gap in the 2012 election and how NOW's defensive strategy may change in the post-election period.
Women voted for Obama in such large numbers that it just simply overwhelmed the support for Mitt Romney. The gender gap for President Obama was, based on how you count it, as much as 18%. I saw one estimate of roughly 20% gender gap. That is, I think, a large of historic proportions. And it's not just the gender gap of who women voted for. One of the most interesting things to me is that some of the exit polls asked people what were the issues that were most important to them. Now, clearly, jobs and the economy were the most important for both men and women. But even when you look at their idea about what the issues are, you see some emerging differences, sort of systematic differences between women and men. So women seemed systematically to be more interested in government's role in helping people get health care that they need, in government's role in supporting education. And I think it's important to put those two facts together, that on the issues, women do think that government has a very important role to play in maintaining a middle-class society, a society that has the wherewithal to allow people to contribute to their communities, each in their own way. And we put that together with the fact that women overwhelmingly, I think, are the reason that Barack Obama was reelected and the reason that we have so many more progressives coming into, especially the United States Senate. I think that the lame duck Congress as well as the new Congress needs to understand the direction that the country clearly wants to move in.
How important was it that we had a number of firsts in this election? There are a number of states who are sending a U.S. senator, a female U.S. senator, to Washington for the very first time. We have the first openly lesbian senator, Tammy Baldwin, elected. And there are a number of other firsts. I wonder if you'd summarize some of those for us. It's hard to remember them all, right?
I know. It's really wonderful. So Tammy Baldwin, the first openly lesbian senator in the United States Congress. Elizabeth Warren, the first woman from Massachusetts sent to the United States Congress. Mazie Hirono, the first Asian-American woman. She's from Hawaii, serving in the United States Congress. Let's see who else. Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota, first woman senator from North Dakota. New Hampshire has sent the first all-woman delegation to the United States Congress. So, you know, it's interesting. We had all of these candidates that really are not just Democrats. And let me tell you the truth. In my organization, we are very picky about who we give an endorsement to. It's very difficult for Democrats to get the now endorsement, let alone Republicans. But we have an enormous number of now endorsed candidates that are coming into both the Senate and the House of Representatives, and that, I think, is extremely important.
Where do you think things will go now? I can't help but think that on issues like pay equity as well as reproductive rights, the access to contraceptives, and a number of other important issues raised during this campaign, that the equal rights movement, Feminist National Organization of Women, and a number of other groups have been on the defensive for so long.
Yeah.
Do you see now formulating a strategy that would go on the offense to take more ground in terms of these rights, to expand these rights, instead of always standing trying to protect them?
Absolutely. I think that's exactly what the women's movement needs to do. We have been pushed back. Kirsten Gillibrand has been, for 2 years, going around the country saying the women's movement has stalled out. And it's galling to hear that, but it's absolutely true. And what the women's movement needs to do is to wrap our brain around the fact that we have been pushed out. We have been forced into a stall-out position. And now, especially with these elections, this is an opportunity for us to move forward. I think that the Republican Party is trying to regroup. I think that there's going to be a number of people in the Republican Party that are already saying we've gone way too far to the right. We have allowed the radical fringe to take over the levers of power in the Republican Party, and that's a bad idea. It's going to take them some time for the more moderate voices in the Republican Party to take back power, which they do not have right now. But I think that is going to be an effort. What concerns me is that as the self-styled moderates try to take back power, they will do so without recognizing women's fundamental rights. And we are going to be there every step of the way to challenge the moderate Republicans to step up and recognize the full humanity of women and the full right of women to have access to the entire range of health care needs that they have. And that includes very especially their reproductive health care needs, birth control, abortion, prenatal care, STD and HIV screening, a comprehensive sex education. These are things that are being withheld from women all around the country. And by the way, that has resulted in the United States having the highest infant and maternal mortality rates of any industrialized country and a higher rate than many developing countries. So we're going to be there to force these conversations. We're going to be saying to the Republicans, y'all want to move to the center? Move to the center with respect to women's access to health care, or you're not serious, and we will defeat you every step of the way.
That was Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women. Learn more about NOW's work on reproductive rights and pay equity by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Under California's groundbreaking global warming legislation, Assembly Bill 32, carbon pollution allowances will be auctioned off for the first time on November 14th. The law requires the state's biggest power generators and industries to either reduce their greenhouse gas emissions or buy permits to pay for their pollution. Together, these sectors account for about 85% of California's greenhouse gas emissions, and the program's goal is to reduce emissions 15% by 2020. Although several northeastern states initiated a compact a few years ago called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGI, it applies only to pollution generated by electric utilities, whereas the California program is much broader. Six other states had originally planned to join California in a Western States initiative, but all have since dropped out. AB 32, the Global Warming Solutions Act of 2006, generated fierce opposition from polluting industries. The law was challenged by Proposition 23 on the November 2010 ballot, which sought to suspend AB 32 until state unemployment stayed below 5.5% for four consecutive quarters, which hasn't happened in 30 years. After Proposition 23 lost decisively, 62-38%, the California Air Resources Board has moved forward to implement the law that includes a carbon cap-and-trade system and other components. While opponents say AB 32 will cost jobs, supporters assert the law will create new jobs in the green economy. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Reverend Sally Bingham, an Episcopal priest who founded Episcopal Power and Light in 1997 as a religious response to climate change. In 2000, the name was changed to Interfaith Power and Light, with congregations of many faiths joining in. The group now has chapters in 40 states. Here, Reverend Bingham discusses why climate change is an issue of concern to faith communities and the role Interfaith Power and Light played in the passage of AB 32.
AB 32 is particularly important to the faith community because we believe that we are the stewards of creation, and we see climate change and too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is very detrimental to God's creation in that it is affecting all aspects of life. I mean, whether it's fires or droughts or severe storms like the one was just experienced in the Northeast, where climate change doesn't cause those storms, it does cause them to be a great deal more severe. The periods of rain and the periods of drought and heat are more extreme now, and this is what scientists predicted 30 years ago, and now we're beginning to see it here. And we see AB 32 as a beginning step on how to do that. It's also particularly important because it's the only, if you will, global warming bill in America. And people from all over the country, probably all over the world, are watching to see, will it be successful and will it accomplish all the things that the writers of the bill hope that it will? And I believe that it will. I think it deserves a yeoman's opportunity to get started. And it will create jobs. It'll put more money into research and development for renewable energies. And in the long run, it's going to help our health and our well-being as we move forward.
Can you say anything specific about how these different faith communities are engaging with the political process, you know, that led to the passage of AB 32?
Well, before AB 32 was actually even brought into law, before Governor Schwarzenegger is the one that signed that bill, and I was lucky to be invited to stand with him when he signed that bill in Sacramento, and he also did a signing here in San Francisco. The religious community was talking to legislators frequently and urgently about the fact that climate and the changing climate is a moral issue, because not addressing climate change is allowing for one group of people to be prosperous at the expense of others. And we see that as a moral issue, because the more greenhouse gases that we put in the atmosphere, the more the extreme of the climate change happens, and the people that suffer the most are the poor and the least able to mitigate and recover after disasters. The poor people are the ones that are affected the most, and they have contributed the least to the problem. That's why we see it as such an important moral issue. So we worked on that premise for 2 or 3 years before AB 32 was actually signed into law. Now that we have the opportunity to auction off some of the credits, this is in the cap and trade aspect of the bill, we will see some funds being accumulated that can go back to those low-income communities. We can have some of that money go into the research and development of renewable energy. So all aspects of AB 32 are important. And the auction is important because it allows for some funds to be developed to use for those other issues that are also connected to clean air and clean water, to make sure that those communities have the funds to do what they need to do to keep their air clean. And if it involves putting scrubbers on power plants, the money will go towards that, and it will help in terms of their ability to stay as healthy as everybody else is.
Reverend Sally Bingham, what you've been talking about is what many activists call environmental justice. You know, that is the fight to make sure that the poor and people of color have equal access to clean air, clean water, and healthy open spaces. Is there any other aspect of AB 32 that relates to that?
The clean fuel standards that California has implemented, and which is also part of AB 32, will help in those low-income communities where they're often having to breathe diesel through traffic. And the cleaner the cars, the cleaner the air is. And that will help low-income communities as well to stay healthy.
That was Reverend Sally Bingham, founder of Interfaith Power and Light. For more information on the group's unique approach to battling climate change, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.